The Guardian.
The Prime Minister clings to his right-hand man and Tories fear the public might never forgive them. I'm Jonathan Friedland, columnist at The Guardian, and this is Politics Weekly.
I believe that in every respect he has acted responsibly and legally and with integrity.
What a week when the government should have been grappling with the coronavirus, focusing on bringing down the numbers of those infected and dying, and planning on how to ease the country safely out of lockdown. They have been consumed instead by the actions nearly 6 weeks ago of a single unelected political advisor. As most of you will know by now, at 8 p.m. on Friday evening, The Guardian, together with colleagues at the Daily Mirror, broke the news that Dominic Cummings, the Prime Minister's chief advisor, broke lockdown rules on several occasions, rules that he himself had played a key role in drawing up. The following days have seen not only the public, but many Conservative MPs and Tory commentators turn on Cummings. The Daily Mail has been particularly brutal, as have the latest polls, which show the public united in its damning verdict on Cummings. But, as we record, the person who matters most is holding firm. Boris Johnson is standing by his man. The Prime Minister will appear before senior MPs at just around the time this show goes out, during which he's bound to be asked about the Cummings odyssey to County Durham. So, can the government ride this out? Why exactly is Boris Johnson so determined, even desperate, to hold on to Dominic Cummings, even if that means compromising his entire public health message and seeing his poll numbers fall through the floor? Can Downing Street come back from this? Plus, remember Brexit. Even as we wrestle with the pandemic, talks with the EU have continued and subsequently stalled in the last few weeks. I'll be joined by Jill Rutter and Robert Colville to discuss whether the coronavirus crisis should be changing the UK government's plan to negotiate a trade deal with the EU by the end of the year. Can we really afford to crash out of the EU when we're already braced for one of the worst recessions ever to hit the country? That's all in this week's Politics Weekly. Last week we got a taste of the quieter life in Westminster. Boris Johnson wasn't seen except for a showdown at PMQs, Prime Minister's Questions, and his weekly venture to the number 10 doorstep to clap for carers. But this week is very different, and certainly a week the government would hope to forget. To discuss the latest, on the line now, I'm joined by Rowena Mason, The Guardian's deputy political editor. Rowena, you've mentioned to us before that you're working from home with your husband and a small toddler, and that it has been tricky sometimes, even occasionally perhaps feeling a little bit poorly. At any point throughout lockdown, have you thought of just packing up and driving miles across the country to get some childcare?
It is probably the absolute last thing on my mind that I would, thinking that I'd contracted coronavirus, drive halfway across the country to see elderly parents or slightly older parents. It's just inconceivable. I can't think of why anybody would do that. And just, has Dominic Cummings never heard of Paw Patrol or Postman Pat or sticking your child in, you know, in front of anything? You do anything, don't you, when you're feeling ill? You know, you let them eat what they want for a week, peanut butter sandwiches and biscuits, just to get through it. But no, I mean, it's just, I find it completely inconceivable.
And Rowena, you're not just a parent, you're a political correspondent. You are looking at legislation and rules and regulations passed by the government for a living. This is your job. Were you even aware of this loophole that Dominic Cummings cited?
Well, unless there's something that we don't know about Dominic Cummings' child that makes him exceptionally vulnerable, it's hard to see how his situation can be considered an exception. And some people, Jess Phillips, a Labour MP, for example, is saying that that clause in the regulations is actually connected to children who are so vulnerable that they could be suffering from domestic violence or abuse or living in very squalid conditions and might have to seek new accommodation. Not just simply that you think you might not be able to cope with your four-year-old if you think you're coming ill. I mean, it's worth saying that at the time when Cummings took that decision as well, he's confirmed that neither he nor his wife had classic coronavirus symptoms So they were really sort of predicting a future situation that hadn't actually come to pass yet.
Now, let's talk about the politics of this, Rowena. We've obviously heard lots about Dominic Cummings and his movements, etc. But the interesting politics in this is how the wider Tory party have responded, the government, and crucially Boris Johnson. Do you think Boris Johnson and those around him failed to anticipate the level of anger that the public have been expressing when they went immediately into defence mode of Cummings as soon as the Guardian and Mirror story broke?
Yes, I think they did underestimate the level of public anger. And it's ironic given that Johnson and Cummings have sought to present themselves from the beginning as a government for the people and of the people, a team that disdains elites, Ramona elites, as they would say. It seems on this they were very much out of touch. And even now, Number 10 and its supporters are trying to spread this theory that actually the public isn't as angry as opinion polls might suggest, that they're now getting bored with wall-to-wall coverage of it and they want to move on. But that seems to me wishful thinking. I mean, some of the surveys that we've seen in the past couple of days show unprecedented drops in popularity and approval ratings, both for Boris Johnson and his government in general. And the gap with Labour has narrowed substantially. And he really did misjudge from the start how people would react to this.
Now, many have commented on the pretty well, obviously, coordinated response that came via Twitter from Michael Gove, Rishi Sunak, Dominic Raab. Straight away, they were sort of saying it's no crime to be a loving dad, you know, variations on those themes. When did you start noticing that there were other Tory MPs, perhaps outside that inner circle, who were not as willing to side with and defend Cummings?
It really was sparked when Steve Baker, who's a backbencher, a very influential Brexiteer, sent out an article entitled Cummings Must Go. That was the catalyst for it. He's had long-time tensions with Cummings, so it's not like they're particularly, it's not like an ally turning on him. But that sort of opened the way for a trickle of Conservative MPs throughout the course of the day on Sunday and Monday to start saying that they were not happy with Cummings' actions. And a lot of it was letters to constituents. Some of it was statements on Facebook or on their websites. And then that turned into a stronger flow of them on Monday when the Scotland Office Minister, Douglas Ross, resigned with this blistering letter that said that he could not condone what the Prime Minister's senior aide had done. And then just more and more were coming out over the course of that day. And so it's probably up to about 40 now. And there are a few more around the edges who are very critical, but stop short of saying that he should resign, calling for perhaps an independent investigation or some other punishment. But those are just the on the record people. There are more off the record who are conveying their extreme frustration and annoyance that Cummings has been allowed to keep his job.
He then, Dominic Cummings, did this press conference on the Monday in the Rose Garden, with a place that previously had been associated with sort of either the Prime Minister himself or, you know, visiting leaders. Have you ever seen a government advisor get this level of support from the very top, even the trappings, the bells and whistles of the Downing Street Rose Garden?
It's pretty extraordinary that he was allowed to make that statement in such an official context. And it gave us a clue before it happened that he would come out fighting and he would come out with the official backing of the Prime Minister. It's pretty unprecedented for a special advisor to be allowed to speak in public for themselves in that sort of way. Usually the code suggests that they shouldn't be doing that they very much serve behind the scenes and work for their ministers, who are the ones that speak out politically and in public. So it just shows how extraordinarily powerful, influential, central Dominic Cummings is to the Downing Street operation, that he's been granted this luxury of being able to explain himself. And the fact that Boris Johnson has stood behind him full square on both the Sunday and the Monday, taking the press conferences and both those days in order to defend him, it shows how important he is to Boris Johnson's premiership.
What exactly explains why he feels this need to hold so fast to Dominic Cummings now?
I think there's two elements to it. One is that there's a very much an all for one and one for all mentality among the former Vote Leave advisers who form the central part of the Downing Street operation. And so if Dominic Cummings were to go, you could see a sort of an exodus of some others as well, potentially. And Boris Johnson very much relies on them all to keep the show on the road. And secondly, Johnson is still absolutely wedded to carrying out Brexit in the vision of Dominic Cummings, and feels that he needs him there to maintain Steele, to stop a swing towards a softer Brexit. And even though we've got this huge global pandemic, this huge crisis going on in the country, he still has an eye on Brexit and wants Dominic Cummings to be there in order to push that through in the way that he wants.
And I think that probably is the only way to explain this 5 or 6 day period, where I think all of us who've ever covered politics would say by now a regular advisor in this degree of trouble would have gone by now. When the Conservatives won such a big majority back in December, there was a feeling of, well, now that means Boris Johnson and his government are all but untouchable. They will be masters of all they survey. But in the last couple of weeks, there was that very interesting U-turn by the government, forced on them partly by the opposition and partly by Tory backbenchers, which was to cut the NHS surcharge that had been levied on migrant NHS and care workers, and showed that this government, you know, could be for turning. What do you think, there could be a repeat of that now, given that you've said it's about 40 as we speak, publicly calling for Cummings to go, almost certainly more behind the scenes? Can Johnson be pushed again?
There is still a substantial proportion of the Conservative Party who are Conservative MPs who are remaining loyal, probably with one eye on their future prospects, given that they're taking a calculation that Cummings might very well survive, and who among them would want to be on his blacklist if he does. So I think really the chances of Cummings staying in his job depend on whether those key members of the cabinet, whether they will continue to back him, and whether there's any future events that become a turning point. If anything more comes out about Cummings's movements, if it emerges that he's misled the public in any way or the Prime Minister in any way, or if it leads to such a comprehensive breakdown in the lockdown that deaths start spiking again and local outbreaks start arising and people draw the conclusion that Cummings' actions are to blame for that.
Let's move away from Dominic Cummings, because that has consumed so much of the oxygen in the air that we have barely had time to draw breath and look at other things the government is doing, particularly that the government did make a pretty significant announcement in terms of the easing of lockdown. And that was this date for when retailers can get back to work. They've said that on June the 15th, shops deemed non-essential will now be able to reopen. When are we likely to hear more announcements on the easing of social distancing, perhaps, which many of us are keen to know, or at least on socialising, being able to see friends and family, even if we do maintain our physical distance?
I think that will be coming in the next few days. One interesting thing is that I think another misreading of the public mood has been Boris Johnson's keenness to talk about ways to get the economy restarted, talk about shops and car showrooms and outdoor open air markets, when really the question that everybody in the country wants to know is when they can hug their parents again, when they can return to socialising with their nearest and dearest. So I think that they realise they're going to have to say some more on this. The trouble is, the science shows this is the riskiest area for easing the lockdown. And we know that one thing possibly on the agenda is allowing people to socialise more in gardens. But I think the idea of social bubbles, joining households together, has dropped slightly off the radar because of the complexities of that, the difficulties, the arguments and problems with enforcing it that it might cause. So I think we'll find out more in possibly tomorrow, when there's a review of the lockdown. Number 10 realised that they have slipped up by not talking enough about this, and they might try and set out some kind of stage post along the way for when we can see some easements. But as to the question about when you can go for a cup of tea with your sister or your brother, or use your parents for childcare again, I mean, it's still very much up in the air, and that is the question that everybody still wants to know.
Pulling all this together then, Rowena, we've talked a lot about Dominic Cummings, but the figure who matters most, obviously, is his boss, Boris Johnson. How badly do you think his standing has been tarnished by this whole episode? Can he claim ever again, do you think, to be the kind of people's prime minister he campaigned as back in December?
Absolutely, certainly, his reputation has taken a huge blow from this. He's used up, as Tory MPs like to say, he's used up a huge amount of political capital on saving Dominic Cummings. The view from within Number 10 is that, yes, absolutely, they can bounce back. An election is a very long way off. But you could point to the premiership of Gordon Brown, for example, where he took a huge his approval ratings took a huge dive, and he never really recovered before the 2010 election. That took, you know, that was several years of unpopularity before he eventually ended up losing his premiership to David Cameron. It could go either way, really. It depends on. It depends really how long this pandemic goes on for and how bad the repercussions for the lockdown are as a result of this episode.
And you mentioned the breaking of Gordon Brown, which took 3 years to play out. I've had in my mind John Major, whose power in a way was broken 5 years before the election came around. But these are exactly the kind of parallels that are in people's minds. For now, Rowena Mason, The Guardian's deputy political editor, thank you very much.
Thank you.
After the break, we're going to look at some non-coronavirus news, focusing on a minor little matter known as Brexit. We'll be right back.
Hey, it's Leia Green here. I want to tell you about a new podcast we're launching, and we want to get you involved. It's called All By Ourselves, and right now we're collecting stories about relationships, life events, and our inner selves. Anything that's significant for you at the moment.
The curtain goes round the coffin while you listen to some bit of Mozart or whatever it is, and that feels very strange.
Oh, my brother, he suffers from schizophrenia. He's got this, like, really weird thing in his head where he thinks, like, I'm like a witch.
So if you have a story you want to share, big or small, funny or tragic, weird or wonderful, get in touch. Email us on all.by.ourselves@theguardian.com. Or visit gu.com/ABO.
Now, as we know, it's been a week jam-packed with explosive political news in the UK, but do you remember when Brexit was the biggest issue on our minds? For most, Brexit is no longer the main topic of discussion at the lockdown dinner table. A sure way to ensure you're socially isolated would be to bring it up. But that doesn't mean the Brexit caravan has stopped. On the contrary, talks between Britain and the EU have continued behind the scenes, although they haven't gone swimmingly. Tempers flared between the two sides as each accused the other of derailing negotiations. Now, you'd think that the UK economy was reeling enough from the COVID pandemic, and so surely the government would be stretching every sinew to get functioning, settled trade arrangements with the EU and avoid, at all costs, crashing out with no deal. You might think that, but guess what? To discuss what the latest round of Brexit talks have taught us about the government's plans for securing a trade deal, I'm joined by Jill Rutter of the independent research group UK in a Changing Europe and the director of the centre-right think tank, the Centre for Policy Studies, Robert Colville. Robert, good to be with you. It does seem odd to be talking about Brexit. It has gone very prominently back to the back burner, hasn't it?
Yeah, it feels like I'm sort of putting on an old suit, which doesn't really fit very well. And I'm sort of noticing, you know, pre-lockdown, it used to be, you know, something we talked about all the time. It was the absolute focus of British politics. And now it's kind of completely slipped below the radar.
And it has become almost a nerd issue, as just for sort of specialists only, as opposed, as you say, to the dominant issue. Nevertheless, there has been some action behind the scenes, really, or away from the media spotlight. And in the middle of this month, the talks were continuing behind the scenes. In the middle of this month, they got pretty heated when Britain's chief Brexit negotiator, David Frost, issued an ultimatum to Michel Barnier, saying the EU had 2 weeks to drop its ideological approach to this issue. It does feel as if the temperature is rising a bit. How conscious is the government of this legally binding deadline that is looming for June, by which time Britain has to make a decision on extending the transition period for talks.
Its position is very much informed by what happened last time. You can see that in the publication of its own set of legal papers, because the diagnosis is that, you know, Theresa May, one of the problems they had was that Europe published its draft paper, we didn't publish ours, so we ended up, you know, negotiating off the basis of Europe's rather than ours. And I think in terms of the June deadline, I think obviously they're conscious of it. I think there is a sense that deadlines can be adjusted, that the evidence of the last time is that when there is agreement, things move very, very quickly. I don't think they're going to feel, if there's no agreement by that after heads of government meeting, that we are absolutely bound to have a no deal Brexit. I think they will think that there is still time to for things to play out.
And Michael Gove, didn't he, gave evidence to the House of Lords EU committee a few weeks back and did, I think echoing what you've just said there, said that Brussels and the UK could negotiate a trade deal with tariffs on goods, at least, in 6 months, which is pretty short. EU diplomats at the time were quick to dismiss that as unworkable. But given the circumstances, do you think the UK could actually get the EU to see it its way and find some leeway on the timing?
There is a philosophical gap between the two sides as to what they see a deal looking like. You know, and I think there's an irony here that in the first stages of negotiations, we kept on being told Britain cannot have a special status. It needs to choose from a range of off-the-shelf options. And now Britain is saying we want to choose from a range of off-the-shelf options, i.e. Canada. And the EU is saying, no, because you are so close to us, you need to have a special status. So the gap between what the two sides want is the sort of the key issue. And I think there are all sorts of thorny issues around, you know, level playing field, fisheries, all the rest of it. At the moment, it's not quite a dialogue of the deaf, but, you know, we're still in that stage of negotiations where both sides are insisting on their core principles and their core approach. And we haven't yet got to the point, which will probably only come under time pressure, when they sort of feel the need to actually make a deal or maybe not make a deal. Maybe, you know, there's a feeling that, well, you know, COVID is such a huge issue that we won't actually notice the consequences of no deal. You know, the idea of, you know, there being a queue of trucks wanting to come into this country would be a sort of a nice thing to have at this point when no trucks are coming into the country.
We'll come back to that point and pick it up in a moment. I just want to see if we can bring Jill Rutter back in. Jill, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Oh, how wonderful, because we've had a few technical difficulties in this conversation, but great, you're back there. But Michael Gove reluctantly admitted in one appearance that the UK could end up like Canada, his words, meaning they could end up with a deal that includes some tariffs and quotas on agricultural goods, which is obviously a mile away from the zero tariff, zero quota trade deal that was once promised and that the two sides are trying to achieve. Do you think that shows that there is actually some wriggle room there for the British government? It's prepared to budge, it's prepared to shift, or do you think that shows that the two sides are in some ways talking at cross purposes?
I think it shows that they're still talking at cross purposes, because I don't think the sort of tariffs Michael Gove was floating answer the EU's points on level playing field. The EU is worried about unfair competition from the UK across the board, and having a few tariffs on agriculture doesn't really solve that concern. And indeed, the EU rejected that idea from Michael Gove pretty much out of hand, and also noted that a line-by-line tariff negotiation really takes a long time, and there are a huge number of EU interests they would have to be lining up. They don't have a mandate for that negotiation. It would take some time to get it. So I don't think that's a real answer. I think where Michael Gove has made gestures that would go beyond what the UK is offering in the draft text that they tabled last week is where he has said that the UK would sign up to some sort of, you know, stronger no regression clauses, perhaps linked to UK law rather than EU law, which would take out the role for the ECJ, which is something of an anathema. So you can see some sorts of landing zones. The UK could also just note to the EU that if they don't like what the UK is doing on level playing field, they can always impose punitive tariffs back. I mean, that's a sort of trade defence measure they could take. So that's another way forward. There's no real reason to sign up to those up front. So I think, you know, there may be some sort of areas for movement between the two, but at the moment they're both digging themselves into their respective trenches.
And Robert Colbert, I'm sure you would say, yeah, and that's normal in any kind of talks process. The two sides take up maximalist positions first, very stubborn, say that there's no way we're ever going to get a deal, and then things move.
Yes, absolutely. Except that the difference in dynamic this time is that, you know, under Theresa May, in the first set of negotiations, essentially, you know, if you remember Michel Barnier's famous staircase, you know, Theresa May was desperate to avoid Britain being pushed down the staircase. Now, you know, the new government is desperate to avoid being pulled up the staircase. They are, you know, philosophically committed to, you know, maximising the benefits of divergence, to, you know, of being able to do all the things the EU wouldn't let you do. And so they are kind of resisting being pulled back into a closer regulatory orbit.
And what the EU has done so far is they have, in these talks, accused the UK of picking and choosing the bits that suit Britain best. And I suppose that actually gives Britain a kind of alibi, doesn't it? Because if the Europeans keep saying it's Britain that is cherry picking and that's impossible, that allows then the Boris Johnson government to say, well, look, we did try to get this deal, but they just weren't reasonable.
Yeah, and I think, you know, both sides are cherry picking away, as you would expect. You know, the EU has been, you know, has been cherry picking, you know, itself throughout this process in terms of, you know, saying that there are things that Britain absolutely can't have, which it wants. I think, you know, we are currently in that kind of state of negotiation. But I think the difference, as I said, is that, you know, I think there is less concern about no deal than there was.
Jill, the thing hovering over all of this is the scenario of a failure to reach agreement, a refusal by the British government to extend the transition to allow more talking, and therefore instead exiting the European Union arrangements fully on December the 31st and, as it were, crashing out into the no-deal setup. Now, the assumption a lot of people, I suppose, have made is that the last thing the UK economy will need in the midst or at the end even of a pandemic, which has sent the country into a what some say is going to be the largest recession since this early 1700s, the last thing it's going to need is to then have all the trauma and difficulty of no deal. Or are you thinking and picking up that actually the UK government is thinking that any damage that's caused by no deal will be, as it were, sort of covered up by the damage inflicted by coronavirus? And quoting my colleague Marina Hyde, who rather brilliantly said that the government might be embracing the timing with the sweaty gratitude of a guy who knows that the unfortunate fire at a storage unit facility will take care of the corpse he's been storing there.
I was actually going to quote that Marina Hyde line, which I think is absolutely fantastic about that. I think there are undoubtedly some people in government who see, they acknowledge that there will be a hit up front to the UK from leaving the EU without a trade deal in place. There will be some disruption. And you could say the economic figures, we just can't compare one quarter to another anymore because the economic figures are just, you know, out of sight, figures we've never, ever seen before. And why not just hide the bit of no deal Brexit from that? And then we'll have a coronavirus recovery and we can claim it's a recovery due to our form of Brexit as well. So what's not to like? I think the problem, though, I think Robert is being far too cavalier about the prospect of no deal at the end of the year. One of the things that coronavirus has definitely done, it has dramatically reduced the bandwidth in business for preparing for no deal. So there's an article in today's Financial Times which is talking about the fact that virtually no one has signed up for these customs courses. Michael Gove said we needed 50,000 people employed in the private sector to comply with customs formalities by the end of the year. I think so far, halfway through the year, they look as though they've trained maybe 2,000, maximum 3,000. So that's way off course. Businesses haven't got the bandwidth to prepare. The other thing is, what is the supply chain that has held up best during the coronavirus crisis? It's the food supply chain. That's gone brilliantly. It's perishable food at Dover, at Calais, that is most at risk if we exit with no deal. It's that sort of disruption. We've already seen some just-in-time manufacturers making sort of big layoffs. Yeah, it's quite difficult to say, is that a Brexit layoff? Is that a coronavirus layoff? Is it a general just change in demand in the world? But I do think that you should not just think, this will be easy, we can hide it all away, particularly if the economy is starting to come back. Coronavirus has shut down the services economy, the face-to-face services economy. That's actually not the economy that's affected by a no-deal Brexit. That's a manufacturing and the agri-food economies, and those are the bits that are working relatively well at the moment.
And Robert Colville, you're being cavalier about the prospect of no deal.
Not at all. I want there to be a deal. I want there to be a good deal. As I did last, in the first round. When the coronavirus hit, there was an anecdotal sense. You talk to businesses, you talk to MPs. Of course we're going to have an extension. You don't want to have the coronavirus hit to businesses and then a no deal hit. And government, it will struggle to find the bandwidth to cope with both of these things at once. And that's kind of been replaced by a sense, as the kind of crisis has developed, of actually there's no point in having a transition purely for the sake of extension. If we are still at this impasse and we extend, then we're just going to be at this impasse again in a year's time, and we're probably going to be on the hook for having to pay into the next EU budget, which is going to be a really fraught negotiation. And we're not going to be able to, suddenly all the people we've been negotiating trade deals with, we're going to have to say, actually, when we said this is going to kick in January next year, what we actually meant is it's going to kick in at some point. We can't actually tell you when. So there are trade-offs on that. But I think that their point is, as long as that central philosophical gap between the two sides remains, the only thing which solves that is time pressure. It's not as if we extend, then people are going to spend the next year being constructive and resolving all the problems, and it's going to get us to a better deal in the end. It's just going to mean that that everyone just digs their heels in, and then we argue about the same stuff as the clock ticks down.
Let me make a case for exactly that, though. I mean, for an extension, literally for an extension's sake, which is the coronavirus factor, that right now the country, as Jill said, doesn't have the bandwidth. Everyone's got this huge headache to deal with. And actually just having another year with no illusions that we'll do anything other than kicking the can down the road, that seems like quite a good option, given how much we've got on our national and collective plate.
But you can make the counter argument that if there are things you want to do to galvanise the economy, which Europe currently won't let you do, then you might want to get things done out of the way. And there are things that you can do. I mean, one of the issues that's dividing the two sides at the moment is state aid rules. Now, obviously, I'm director of the Centre for Policy Studies. I'm not a big fan of state aid. I think the market is a wonderful thing. But there's no doubt that, the government thinks there are things that you could do to galvanise the economy, which you currently can't. I mean, obviously my hope would be that as the clock ticks down, both sides get together and, they do come up with a deal that works for both sides, where we get as much access as possible to the EU while preserving as much of our autonomy as possible, and that the line on that is drawn in the right place.
As you can both imagine, in the rest of this programme, we're going to be talking a lot about Dominic Cummings. I'm not going to ask the two of you to relitigate that issue at all. But given that he was the mastermind behind the campaign that won the referendum for Brexit, what impact... I'll put this to each of you. What impact do you think it has that the man seen as the brains behind Vote Leave campaign is, whichever way you slice it, his standing and reputation is affected by what we have seen in this last week? Start with you, Jill Rutter.
I don't think it makes any difference really to the Brexit decision, because I'm sure that Brexit voters wouldn't want to see themselves as solely following the Dominic Cummings line. I think the really interesting thing is if his position within government is eroded or ultimately proves unsustainable, whether that makes a difference to the sort of Brexit that the Boris Johnson government pursues. Because what you can see is that Dominic Cummings was very much the brains behind the tactics that got Boris Johnson to pivot towards that Northern Ireland deal last autumn, then to take the get Brexit done message through, get it through a reluctant parliament. I mean, he really was the mastermind, I think, of the process of getting us out in very unpromising circumstances after all Theresa May's travails last year, and then winning the election and stacking up that big Conservative majority. And I think if he's forced to play a diminished role going forward, I think the really interesting question is, does that change the type of Brexit? Is he the hard man saying don't contemplate any extension at all? Would Boris Johnson hold his nerve in the same way without Dominic Cummings there?
There's a tendency to see Dominic Cummings as an almost superhuman figure, which ties in with this sort of conspiracy theory that people only voted for Brexit because Dominic Cummings wrote a number on a bus. Obviously, take back control was a great slogan. Get Brexit done was a great slogan. But it wasn't the slogans that won the campaigns. It was the fact that they encapsulated widespread popular sentiment. So, I think it's not just you know, Dominic Cummings sitting in there in Downing Street saying, we really like Brexit. I mean, you know, quite a lot of the people in there around him and around Boris Johnson were the people who ran Vote Leave. You know, it's David Frost. I've not met him that often, but he's never struck me in his media appearances as someone who needs Dominic Cummings to be stiffening his sinews.
Robert Colville, Jill Rutter, thank you both very much indeed.
Thank you.
Thank you.
That's all from us for this week. For anyone wanting to hear more on the latest Brexit talks and how the Dominic Cummings story first broke, head over to The Guardian's Today in Focus podcast. Just search for Today in Focus wherever you get your podcasts. And lastly, I want to say thank you to all of you who've supported us to date. The Guardian's open journalism connects us and brings us together when we need it most. But today, our advertising revenue and newspaper sales are falling faster than ever before, which means we need your support more than ever. Your contributions will sustain us, make sure that our open journalism stays open during this crisis and beyond. If you'd like to help, please visit gu.com/support podcasts. But for now, I want to thank our guests, Rowena Mason, Jill Rutter and Robert Colville. The producer was Danielle Stevens. I'm Jonathan Friedland. Please do take care of yourselves and thanks for listening.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.